Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 97. Today's interview episode will be with Eric Bork, who was the writer of part 8, The Last Patrol. Sit back, relax, and listen to Eric's stories about how this episode came to be. All right, so Eric, thank you very much for joining me and being willing to talk about your history and your experiences with Band of Brothers. So, I mean, we might as well just start from the beginning. How did you get connected to Band of Brothers?
Well, I had been working at Tom Hanks's production company, which was then called Playtone. Well, still is called Playtone. For years prior, I had been one of his assistants, actually, and he promoted me. I was an aspiring screenwriter, and I was writing scripts on the side, and I had gotten an agent. He eventually read some scripts that I had read, actually sitcom spec scripts of all things, like for shows like Friends and Frasier that I was doing as writing samples to try to get a job in TV comedy. He read those, thought I was a good writer, and eventually promoted me with the first task of helping him with a different miniseries prior to Band of Brothers, which was called From the Earth to the Moon, which was about the Apollo space program. You've talked to Graham Yost, he worked on it,
right?
And Ivan Schwartz as well. And so, and quite a few other people that ended up working on Band of Brothers, Tony Toe being one of the most important.
We know that it's all connected.
Yeah, there's some overlap.
Yeah.
So I got to help Tom figure out the early kind of outline or Bible for From the Earth to the Moon, and then help find writers. And I ended up being one of the writers and ultimately a co-producer on it. And so I got to share in all the accolades and stuff that miniseries got. And Tony Toe, who was co-executive producer of that, who was kind of the guy day-to-day running both productions, as it turned out, he really mentored me a lot. I learned a lot from him. And so between Tom and Tony, they really gave me an incredible opportunity and helped me make the most of it with From the Earth to the Moon. Then I continued to work at Playtone and have other projects I was writing that for, you know, Tom Hanks to executive produce and stuff. But then Band of Brothers came up that he and Steven Spielberg had, you know, pitched it, sold the idea to HBO, and Tom asked me to work on that as well in a similar capacity to what I had done, you know, as a writer and producer. So that's that's how I ended up on it.
Wow. What's it like working with Tom Hanks? I'm sure you get that.
Well, great. I mean, in the early days, it was all the time, it was a little intimidating because he's Tom Hanks and, you know, you're not. And so he was always the sort of, you know, the boss, the, you know, way up who I admired his work and had for years. And I mean, I got to do things like, you know, when I was one of his assistants, he won the back-to-back Oscars for acting. And it was literally my job the next day to take the Oscar statuette to the Academy to get his nameplate put on. So I'm in my beat up Toyota driving to the Academy. Here's Tom Hanks's Oscar. So I did crazy stuff like that as an assistant, always couldn't believe I was working for him and working at this with this high level, you know, high Hollywood level. So then being promoted to help him with From the Earth to the Moon was like my big break. I was, you know, I'd been an aspiring writer in Hollywood for years. And then he gave me this incredible opportunity. So that was my kind of fairy tale, was getting to do From the Earth to the Moon. And, you know, he's very generous in giving people opportunities. He's very, you know, he's extremely funny and smart and passionate about what he does, but also good natured and easygoing, which I guess is what people glean from him, from seeing him in interviews and stuff. That's all true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I owe so much to him and always felt, you know, in his debt.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I see that, you wrote 3 of the episodes from the Earth to the Moon. That's, you know, that's already a big thing, just, you know, to give someone an opportunity and to give them 3 episodes to write, which I mean, is amazing. I mean, I love From the Earth to the Moon also. And, you know, all 3 of the episodes that you've written are ones that I love them all. But, you know, some of them, like the original Wives Club, the structure, you know, of having it tell the story via the wives, via them, you know, on the, you know, in the fashion show and stuff like that. I mean, that's just, wow. That's just great.
I will say, I think the fashion show device was my idea, but I will say that you'll notice some of those writing credits, same on Band of Brothers, are shared credits. And so it wasn't like I would, and what that really means is one writer initiated, then another writer did rewrites later. And sometimes there are uncredited rewrites even beyond that, which I've done some on both series. And with, so like with both miniseries, there were a group of writers who were each assigned like one episode to begin with. So I wasn't like given three. I chose one when I was told I could write one, and I chose the one about Alan Shepard.
Okay.
Then later, I did some rewrites on a couple of other ones after other writers had done, which is why you have split credits there, shared credits. Same thing with Band of Brothers. Episode 8 was my one that I was going to write initially, and I did. And then Bruce McKenna, we had come in and do some rewrites on it because he had done a great job on episode 6, which was his one that he had initiated. Mm-hmm. I was busy rewriting other episodes at that time, some of which I didn't end up with credit on because you have to rewrite a very significant amount to get a share of the writing credit. So then 10, Eric Jenderson had begun, and I did some rewrites of 10 later, which is why it's the two of us. So anyway, that's kind of like inside baseball on how writing credits work. Right.
Obviously. There are rules to these things because, you don't want people fighting about them.
That can happen. I mean, the Writers Guild ultimately decides how the credits work through a committee that reads all the drafts of all the scripts and stuff. So it isn't even us saying this is who gets credit and in what order. It's like a Writers Guild arbitration process.
Right. Okay. All right. So what was the process from your perspective of writing The Last Patrol then, since that was, you know, the episode that you were in charge of structure,
yeah,
I guess.
Well, so I kind of picked that as the one I wanted to write. Like, we kind of figured out how many episodes we were going to have, and Eric Jenderson had done a document that was sort of like, I mean, we had the book and the interviews and additional interviews beyond what was in the book. Eric then did more interviews and wrote up a long sort of a Bible type document,
right,
or outline.
Right.
Sort of
I've
like,
heard about that Bible.
Like,
yes.
And then I think we ultimately cut it down. I think it was going to be 13 and it ended up being 10 episodes, but one of the 10 was The Last Patrol. And I was particularly interested in that one because it felt like it had the most self-contained story with a beginning, middle, and end to it. I initially wrote it from Hank Jones's point of view, which was the character that Colin Hanks ended up playing. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, well, it's a good script, but you can't. And it was like one of the first scripts that was actually, I think it might have been the first or second draft of a script that was finished early in the process. And everybody was kind of like, well, I don't think we can do one that's just from the point of view of the outsider coming in. We need to change that. So it ended up being more Webster's point of view as an insider who had temporarily left and came back. And Webster had a book that he wrote, which was helpful, you know, too.
Right.
And so anyway, I liked the self-contained story of it, you know, with that patrol and the canceling of the second patrol, which was that scene was like the audition scene we used for Winters, for the actors to play Winters, was that scene where he says, you know, you're going to say that you came back and couldn't get any prisoners, that whole speech that he gives, which of course really happened. And I wrote my best shot at like what he might have said, basically, which was one we used for, we auditioned many, many, many actors for Winners before we found Damian Lewis.
Right. And were you part of the casting process also then?
I was there. I mean, when I say we, I think Steven Spielberg saw him on stage in Hamlet in London and, with Ray Fiennes and liked him. And that's how we ended up with Damien. But I think prior to that, there auditioned a lot of other people. So I was in the room for a lot of the casting, especially the LA based casting, a lot of the sessions, like when David Schwimmer came in and other people reading for Sobel. But you know, it was me and then it was Tony and it was Tom Hanks and Meg Lieberman, the casting director, and maybe a few other people in those rooms. So I wasn't like the voice in the room, but I was like part of the committee. member of the group.
Right. Now, I think I heard that I mean, you obviously know this better than I do, that originally they wanted to give it to Rick Schroeder, the part of Winters. That's what I had heard. Whether it's true or not, I don't know.
He was definitely in the running and was a serious contender, as I recall.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know if it was ever, we're definitely doing it and then changed course, or if it was just, he's a strong contender.
Right. Okay. Wow. And then the way that episode plays out is, it's an interesting point that you make about the fact that it is more or less a standalone story when most of the others are not.
Well, over time, they became more standalone stories, which was part of the work, I think, of figuring out the episodes. And something that was always an important thing for me in both miniseries was that each episode could stand on its own. And so I think 7 has a beginning, middle, and end. 6, because it's about Roe, has a beginning, middle, and end. They all kind of do. You know, episode 4 is Operation Market Garden and has the beginning, middle, and end. But when we were first mapping them out, to me, 8 especially had that.
And do you still have a copy of that Bible?
I might have a digital one. I probably do somewhere. Maybe just a digital one, or maybe a printout packed away in a box. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, because just the idea of it, you know, here you're, because, you know, usually when someone's making a movie, so you have 2 hours, you know, that you want to fill up. Here you have to fill up 10 hours with basically 10 different stories, and you need connections between all of them. You know, so the idea that it probably took Eric Jenderson a really long time to put together that Bible, you know, in order to, you know, to use that and show it to everyone and say, okay, this is the basis, go work with that.
Yeah, it did take a while, and we made further changes to the plan even after that, because I think it was 13 at that time. And I remember the meeting, I remember the restaurant where Tony Toe and I pitched to Tom after I think we had said maybe it should be 10, and we figured out a different way to divide it into 10, and we pitched it to him. And as I recall, of course, memories are always fuzzy. It's like remembering your war experience when you're a veteran. But I think that it got changed to 10, but I can't remember exactly what the new dividing lines were that made it 10 versus 13 and what we would be taking out or combining. But I know a lot of that early work was like, and what I was obsessed with was, how do you make each one feel like it's got a clear, like, this one makes sense as its own hour, and then we start over for the next hour here, and usually we focus on a new character or set of characters. There's always Winters and Nixon and stuff, but part of it for me too was each episode having a primary character we're following. So like in Graham's episode 7, Graham Yost Lipton, right, as the guy that we're really following all the way through. Like, that wasn't an obvious thing in the beginning that it would be that. Like, it wasn't in the book or the Bible or whatever. Like, it was more like, well, how do we turn these into episode 4? I remember had a lot of like, who should we be following in episode 4 during Market Garden? And then it became the Replacements. Like, I don't remember, but it evolved over time with a lot of discussions and documents and rewrites and new script drafts and new writers writing, you know, different approaches to scripts. So none of it was like set in stone early. It was a ongoing, like, figuring it all out.
Well, and however you look at it, it seems, at least, you know, looking at the final product, that you guys were all able to work out all those kinks. You know, at least it seems that way. I'm sure when you watch it, you can still see the creases along the way of things that, you know, that maybe shouldn't have been done that way or whatever, but, you know, that's the finished product. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I do. I mean, I tend to look at things I wrote that I think could be better. Like, that's one of the main things, or like little performance things or little things that I fought for but didn't win or whatever. I remember even some of those, the interview segments at the beginning, which I really think made a huge difference in the miniseries,
yeah,
you know, having the real veterans. And that was all because Mark Cowan had pitched the idea of doing a documentary, a companion thing, and they did it, and it was so great that we were like, can we steal pieces of that? And I remember being in the editing room with Mark working on, like, which pieces are we going to steal for use at the beginning of each episode. And I remember there was one where I was like, oh, I really think it should be this, and like Tony Toe decided no, it should be like, I look at those little things too. I don't remember the specifics, but I know there were, you know, along the way there's all these creative little battles where different people have different views and somebody gets to decide and somebody's, you know, higher up on the chain or whatever, or the sort of consensus is one way or another. But yeah, I can look at it now and go, well, it really works, and a lot of it is because of what all the hundreds of people did that I had no part in. But I had some part in some of it, and I feel proud, but also like, oh, yeah, I don't know if that was the best line, or I wish I had done this differently or whatever.
Right. Okay. I mean, the documentary that you're talking about is We Stand Together, right?
We Stand Alone Together.
We Stand Alone Together, right.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But are all of the – I'm trying to remember if everything that's in those interviews at the beginning of the episodes also appears in that, or there's also mix and matches there. You know, that some of it appears
probably not. I don't remember, but I think we probably have bits that we use that they didn't use in their finished version, but I can't say for sure.
Right, exactly. Well, again, their finished version is I think it's about an hour. Maybe it's a little more than an hour, but You know, if you have the 3-minute segments for, you know, all 10 episodes, that's already a half hour there. You know, so it's pretty, it's not half of that documentary, because there's a lot more that's going on there also.
Yeah.
But wow. And so in order to work on your episode, on episode 8, you know, did you have the opportunity to sit down with any of the veterans to get stories from them? Or the idea was, okay, I'm going to use the Bible, and whatever's written here, that's going to be used as my jumping off point.
Yeah, the starting point was really the book, the Ambrose book. I can't remember now to what extent the Bible talked a lot about that stuff, if Eric expanded on that or didn't spend a lot of time on that. I can't recall. He might have expanded. I don't remember, but I do know that we had additional interview, like transcripts and tapes, and the ability to interview certain veterans. Although in the case of that episode, it was hard because Webster wasn't alive, although Webster talked about it in his book, and I used some of that in addition to what Ambrose had. But, you know, Jones wasn't alive, and Webster wasn't alive.
Right.
Obviously, Winters was still alive, and I think I talked to him a little bit. I sought out some other people that were maybe tangential parts of that patrol, and I got, honestly, some mixed different memories that contradicted each other. I remember being difficult to, like, figure it all out, and we actually went before we shot anything, but when I was already writing that episode, we visited the house where this really happened.
Oh, wow.
We did this, a few of us did this scout of the real battlefields that Ivan set up, Ivan Schwartz, mm-hmm. and I was there, and Tony and Tom Hanks, and I remember Tom and I going into the actual house, and they didn't speak English really, and they didn't recognize Tom for a while, and then at a certain point they realized...
He looked... You know, at that point, he was like super thin because of Castaway. So no one's going to.
I don't know that he will. I'm not sure that's true, that timing is right at that exact time when we went there. Okay. I don't think he looked different then. I think they just didn't recognize. They didn't realize Tom Hanks was in their house. And at a certain point, it dawned on them, and then they changed. It was funny. But anyway, the like river was like this little tiny thing. And I was like, how could this be a thing they had to do a patrol? Like so, you know, you get these bits of information, you know, 50 years later that are like, I don't know.
Is it possible the water's receded over 50 years?
Maybe, but I can't recall that I got information through extra interviews that greatly helped and expanded on what had originally been there. It was more that I just, you know, I had to just extrapolate from what we knew. Write it from that.
Right. I mean, I obviously, especially, you know, as you mentioned, you're dealing with 50-year-old memories of things. So that already in and of itself is going to make things more difficult, and nobody's going to be able to come to you afterwards and say, this is 100% right and this is 100% wrong, you know, from that perspective.
Correct.
You know, because they might not remember from that perspective also. They might, you know, sometimes maybe some of them would have watched the episode and say, oh yeah, that's what happened, of course. And now that's what's in their memory. You know, what Eric Bork wrote. you've created new memories for them.
Yeah. You know? Maybe.
Do you recall other aspects of Band of Brothers that you were working on throughout the time that that the production was going on, besides writing this episode and writing parts of episode 10?
Well, it was mostly writing related stuff, where I had a sort of, in my producing role, I had a somewhat supervisory role over the writing in general, and some of the other writers, you know, would, you know, I'd be the one like giving the notes on the drafts that would be from other people and me, but I would be like maybe the one to communicate with them. And like a lot of it was about, I mean, we were rewriting all the way through production. So I was kind of like the in-house guy that was often doing rewrites to try to, you know, fix things in certain episodes. So 8 and 10 were the ones I did the most writing on, which is why I have a share of credit on those. But I know I did writing on others as well. Probably the biggest was 4 and 3. I did quite a bit of writing on those. I think I did a little bit on episode 1 at a certain point. And then there were some that I didn't have anything to do with at all. I mean, I was always there as part of the creative team of like kind of trying to oversee the general direction and communicate that, but not physically writing. Like I didn't do any of the writing on 6 or 7 or 9, you know. So, but most of what I was doing had to do with the writers and the writing. kind of all the way through.
Right. And you were and you were basically in England throughout the entire 10-month process of filming then.
No, I was back and forth between LA and England. I lived in LA. I had small kids and I had just had my third kid. So I wasn't full time in England for the whole time, but I definitely spent a lot of time there.
Right. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, the 25 years ago, as you and I know, the world was very different when it comes to communication. You know, just things that you know, seem completely trivial today, back then, you know, were much more difficult. I mean, again, if, you know, there was email, so they could email you drafts and things like that. But, you know, you have to use the dial-up. Take a little while to download.
Yeah, and there was definitely no Zoom calls.
No, definitely not.
We didn't have Zoom or Skype or anything like that.
No, not at all. Wow. That's just great. So did you have interactions with the actors during the course of the production and stuff like that? Or not really?
I did somewhat. Yeah, I did somewhat. Yeah. I mean, part of it was I was the guy they would come to try to, like, get more material for their character in the show.
Okay. Makes sense. Makes sense.
So some of them befriended me for that reason, as I recall, and some of them did or didn't get that because, you know, over time, you know, because we had this, it was a very unique production in that the actors were asked to come be there for the whole time and basically be in the background a lot for other people having important mm-hmm. scenes. Normally, that's not how it works. Professional actors aren't there to be in the background. They're only there when they have a speaking role and they have some important thing to do in a scene. So that was a tricky thing that built, it definitely built the brotherhood and it built the realism, I think, that the show achieved. But it was also, you know, over time, it's like you have all these very talented actors who are kind of like not necessarily doing that much in a given script or a given episode. And those would evolve over time because we're rewriting as we're shooting. And so we would see the dailies of a certain episode and go, this actor, this character is really popping. Maybe we put more of him in some of these later episodes we haven't shot yet, because some of the roles in the episodes were like, historically we knew this person and this person did this particular thing. But like on the patrol in episode 8, for instance, we didn't necessarily know every single person on that patrol, nor was it important that the people on it were the exact historical people that were on it, many of whom weren't even characters in our miniseries because we compressed down to focus on a smaller number. Mm-hmm. Or like in episode 10, we knew we were going to do a variety of different scenes that were about the end of the war for different people. But we could kind of choose which people and which like anecdotes to show, because you didn't necessarily have to have them shooting the camp commandant. You didn't necessarily have to have, you know, Talbert being assigned to Lieutenant Peacock or whatever. But over time, we were like, oh, these are the people who we want to give more material to, or we want to see that character, how they ended up, which we may have not known in early drafts of writing stuff. So it was definitely evolving. And, you know, I had certain meetings with certain actors at times or certain, I remember Matthew Settle had to do a big speech in episode 10 and that was being rewritten and, you know, working with him on that a bit. And, I remember David Schwimmer, we had a meeting, the two of us over coffee, about Sobel's character before episode 1, because like a lot of actors, he had questions and concerns and suggestions that might lead to some rewriting and stuff. And so, but you know, mainly the directors deal with the actors on the set, but as a writer producer, I had some, you know, interaction here right. And there.
I mean, again, it's, you know, I'm always amazed at the fact that, you know, after having read the, you know, the Ambrose book, and then, you know, at the same time watching the miniseries, you see that there's like one, sometimes you'll have one sentence that's mentioned in the book, and then in the miniseries is expanded into, you know, a 3-4 minute segment, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the prime example that I always bring up about this is, you know, the spaghetti scene in episode 1. I mean, I know you didn't write episode 1, but, you know, the idea of that, it's just one line saying, you know, that Sobel decided to have them eat spaghetti and then go for a run. And then, you know, the writer took that and expanded on it. So to me, that's always amazed. It's always amazed me the way that writers can do something like that in this type of story, especially given the fact that this is all, you know, it's based on truth or mostly truth, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, like what percentage do you think the mini, how true do you think the miniseries is to the real life events. And I'm not even saying comparing it to the book, because the book, you can ask the same question about it also. You know, how.
Well, the book, yeah. I mean, the book was a primary source for us because a lot of those guys weren't alive anymore for us to interview, although a lot were. But so if the book got it wrong, we might have got it wrong too, because we used the book. And if the book got it right, we might have got it right too, because we used the book. But there was some stuff that we did, like you said, that wasn't in the book or was expanded on from what was in the book. But I would say not a ton of that. The book definitely was a good structural like blueprint. The thing is, the dialogue is always made up, right? Because you don't know what they said. So the book doesn't have dialogue. The book has people remember.
It does have lines, but you know, it's not necessarily.
Okay. I shouldn't say that, cause I don't remember it specifically, but a nonfiction book like that is normally, it's not scenes with dialogue. It's more people's memories of stuff that happened, right, and how it went down. And so we as writers have to write almost every line of dialogue, and also a lot of the specific actions and the scenes that the book is just sort of generally telling you sometimes what happened. And then we had to turn that into scenes, or we had to decide what the interstitial material was, or how to tell a whole episode focused on this one character's problem. When in the book, you jump around to 20 different people's memory of something, but on screen, you want to follow one guy with one problem, for instance. So a lot of it was like massaging it into that, but still trying to only tell true things that we knew happened, right, but we'd have to tell them in a way where we make up the dialogue and we make up certain details because we don't know, or even how things were choreographed. I remember the Braycor Manor episode 2 assault on those guns, hearing that 3 or 4 veterans who were there had radically different memories of how it happened and how it was laid out. Yeah. And so, you know, you end up having to composite or pick and choose whose version you're going to use or whatever, because there's no definitive truth. And I'm sure if I had been there on that day, my memories would probably 50 years later be, I mean, the fog of war, you know, I mean, I can't even imagine how, you know, you remember your perspective on something. So it's hard to get totally objective.
Right.
Truth.
I mean, one of the things that Graham told me when I talked to him was the fact that, you know, working on Band of Brothers gave him the idea of doing Boomtown, which is that exact idea that here you have a whole bunch of characters and everyone has a different perspective on the same events.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a Rashomon type of thing, you know, yeah. Which again, it's, you know, when you go through Band of Brothers, you do see that also, you know, like, I mean, one of the, you were talking about that, you know, the book was used as a prime source, and, you know, if they got stuff wrong in the book, then it was continued in that direction. I mean, the perfect example of that is the whole idea of Liebgott being a Jew. You know, the book mentions it, but in real life, he wasn't. So someone just thought he was a Jew, said that, and therefore, you know, that snowballed into the whole thing, where in the miniseries, you know, whenever you need to deal with something that deals with a Jew, so you have Liebgott do it, even though in real life, that's not true.
Well, it was more when you needed German translation, Liebgott would do it. And that part, I think, was true.
No, he from what I understand, he did know German, but it wasn't because he was Jewish. Yeah, that was the thing.
No, I understand, right, what you're saying. I understand. But what I'm saying is, I think the miniseries mentions that he's Jewish in episode 1. But most of the time, Liebgott is used as the guy that can speak German, which that part was, right, true. So at camp, right, he wasn't translating because he was Jewish. He was translating because he could speak,
right,
German.
But they you know? It added another emotional level to the aspect of the camp, I guess, believing, right, that he's also a Jew. Yeah, that's
true.
Thing.
Definitely true.
I mean, yeah, again, we also know that Webster was a translator, you know, at least in the miniseries. You know, so you did have others that were able to do translations also, which, you know. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, did you feel that in From the Earth to the Moon, it was the same idea? Or was Chaykin's book more story driven or more dialogue driven?
No, nonfiction books are never story and dialogue driven the way you need them to be for a miniseries. So that part was true, was the same in terms of what the screenwriter's job is. But a difference was Apollo had happened more recently and was more well documented.
And you had more people there who had experienced most of those.
Yeah. And we had Dave Scott as a technical advisor who, you know, had commanded Apollo 15. Mm-hmm. So, whereas we didn't really have a veteran who was, could be that on Band of Brothers, who was one of Easy Company per se. They were much older men, et cetera. So the accuracy thing is an issue either way, but mostly because you're having to write dramatic scenes of dialogue that you don't have, you don't know what was really said or how it really happened. You're relying on, on a general idea of what happened, and then you have to make it very specific as a writer, and you could go really wrong there without meaning to. I remember a thing we did with From the Earth to the Moon, where Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin are kind of talking about who's going to step out first when they get on the moon, because Buzz was interested in maybe being the one. And I remember there was a moment at the end of like they sort of make up about something and they have a quick like bro hug. And I remember Dave Scott saying that would never happen. We did not have that culture where you would ever hug another guy. And so that's the kind of thing you wouldn't know. You might add that because you're thinking in your 1990s LA screenwriter mind, at the end of this scene, the two guys would hug it out, but the astronauts wouldn't. So a lot of it is trying to put yourself in the mindset of that culture and that period, which again was easier for me anyway, although not easy, but easier with the astronauts because many of them had written autobiographies. And it was kind of, there was more to go on. Whereas with veterans of World War II, you're relying on movie depictions, which probably weren't that accurate to begin with, and much more distant memories and a more distant time. And so
And also a group of people
there's
who weren't
that
really
too.
talking about what really happened, and when they finally did open up
Right.
decades later, so there is the idea of time distortion.
I would also say that the way that people talk on screen in Band of Brothers isn't really how 40s people talked, right? So if you wrote it with the kind of, patois and vernacular and whatever that in the real 1940s they really talk like, it would seem dated to 2001 audiences and beyond, because it would be like watching a movie from the 40s. And so we decide earlier on we're not going to have them speak in a 40s kind of way of speaking. So, but if you were there and you see the way these guys talk, you'd be like, well, we didn't talk like that. Like the way the expressions they would use, they would, you know what I mean? It's just different. And those are the compromises you make for the sake of the contemporary
I mean,
audience
I've heard that.
being able to really get into it.
I've heard that Garnier was toned down for the miniseries.
Was toned down. Well, maybe. I don't know that we consciously toned him down. But we certainly probably changed the manner of speaking, somewhat. Although Garnier's probably one that's closer to accurate than others,
That's what I've
maybe,
heard.
because he had such a specific and colorful way of speaking, and he was alive, and Frank got to know him really well. Where I'm just talking more in general, the general way people
Of course,
spoke
of
in the
course.
40s versus how they probably spoke on screen.
Right, obviously. Obviously. But again, when you're writing something, you want it to relate more to the contemporary audience. So that makes sense. It's the same idea when you watch a movie from the 40s, so to us, it might sound strange. To people in the 40s, it sounded okay, but it might also have been wrong at the time, because they were catering to that generation also at the same time. So wow. Okay, you've gone through the production, you've finished everything. The premiere. What was your experience with the premiere? I mean, I've heard stories from different people, but again, I know that everyone has slightly different stories, so.
You mean the Hollywood Bowl
No, the
premiere?
one in Normandy.
Oh, I actually was not able to attend that because I had taken a job on another TV show as a writer that the job started before that, and I could not get out to go to the premiere. So that was one of the real sadnesses for me, that I missed the whole Normandy
Oh, wow.
premiere.
Because of UC Undercover? Was that the TV show?
That's the
Okay.
one. Yeah, that's the one.
So tell me about the Hollywood Bowl premiere then.
I mean, I don't know, there's a whole lot to say. It was cool. I mean, Michael Kamen was there, conducted a whole orchestra doing live music, as I recall. Is that right? Why would he
I
have
don't
done
know.
that?
I
I'm trying to think now,
wasn't
because the movie already had music. I mean, the shows were done and they had the music, so, but I seem to recall he was conducting. I can't remember. I remember very bits and pieces. I don't know that I have much of great interest to say about the premiere. I was there, and it was a cool night for sure. And I remember Tom got up and spoke, and Steven Spielberg might have also spoke. So I remember being there and watching it, you know.
Well, the excuses I've gotten from people when they don't remember things about the premieres and stuff like this is there was a lot of drinking. So that was their excuse, that they don't remember because of that.
Okay.
If you want to use that excuse, that's fine too. Now, had you seen the episodes because of your position? Did you see all the episodes before they premiered, you know, on HBO, or were you watching most of them like everyone else?
No, I'd seen all of them a million times already. I mean, I was there in the kind of editing room, you know, on some of them, working on the cuts with the editors, like giving notes and, you know, tweaks to make the shows work better, especially 10. I did that on episode 10, but all of them I had seen a million cuts, early cuts, too long cuts, the director's cuts, producer's cuts. We showed them to Steven Spielberg, all the cuts, and he had a bunch of notes. I remember like liking a lot of his notes, and in some cases thinking, I actually had that note too, and I said it. No one listened, but I said it. I remember some moments like that. And then, you know, so I was there for the evolution of the post-production of each one. So seeing it at the Hollywood Bowl was seeing something I'd seen a bazillion times already. So it wasn't like, wow, look what it became. It was like I was present. Right. As
you'd already seen the final cut, basically. It wasn't
right. Of everything. Yeah, many cuts of all of them. Right. Yeah.
And do you believe, and obviously your opinion, do you think that they did the right cuts in the end, or were there things that they left on the cutting room floor that they should have? I'm not asking for specific examples, but, you know, are there things that you think that you know, in retrospect after 25 years, that maybe they should have, you know, either gone too far with something, or that maybe they went too far with something?
No, I think everything got better and better and better. And in general, I agree with the final versions and whatever was changed to make them what they were. And in some cases, I had a say in that, others not. If I had anything, they'd be little things, like I said earlier, like, oh, I remember the beginning of one of the episodes and the veteran quotes we used. I wish we could have used that one, but Tony didn't want to use that one, or whatever. Or like this line of dialogue that I wrote and how it was done, But it isn't like the cutting was bad or the episode changed significantly. It was more just like there are little moments where I'm like, the performance here or the writing there isn't exactly what I wish it would be. But it wasn't because it was edited wrong. It was just that is what we had, and that's what was there to be used.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. Are you still in touch with a lot of the people that you worked with on Band of Brothers? Because, I mean, one of the things that I've learned over the course of, you know, these interviews with people is that, you know, it's very rare that 25 years after you do a movie or a series, how, you know, people are still in touch and, you know, sometimes even on a daily basis, you know, that it formed some sort of bond between different people on the production, that this is a very unique case.
Yeah, that's all true. And it was mainly because of the actors. The actors formed a strong bond because of going through boot camp together and being there for the whole 9 months or whatever it was, like I said, which is very rare for a job on a show like that, to just be there in that situation and be in the background and support each other. So they really did create a brotherhood within the actors. And Michael Cudlitz would host barbecues at his house every year to like anniversary of boot camp. And I went to almost all of those over the 20 plus years. I moved from LA to New York a few years ago, but Ivan Schwartz lives real near me. We hang out sometimes. So the different people I stay in touch with, Ross McCall, who played Liebgott, is one of my best friends, who I met on the show. And, you know, Jennifer Jackson, who was my assistant at the time. I mean, there's different people. You know, I saw Tom Hanks not long ago when he was in New York. Ivan and I had lunch with him. But it's really these reunion things. Like a bunch of us were at the World War II Museum in New Orleans a few years ago for a big event. And it was fun to catch up with a lot of actors I hadn't talked to in a while and other people that worked on it. Meg Lieberman, I've stayed somewhat in touch with. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that there are a lot of people from Band that are in my daily life, but it is this sense of ongoing brotherhood. I mean, as a writer producer, I'm not as much in it as the actors, you know, brotherhood, but all of us, I think, feel a sense of kinship that continues on, and you'll see each other at random events where a bunch of people get together just as a kind of reunion, almost like veterans would have a reunion. It is nice that sense of closeness that people have and being part of that in some ways and have it sustained for so many years is really cool. It's one of the real blessings of having worked on it, to be to be connected to right. all that.
And did you ever work on anything else that comes close to that type of, I guess, nostalgia?
I don't think anyone has. I don't think there's anything like it, you know, in terms of like that cast and other people that worked on a show that I know of, because it's a very unique animal. Because even a movie might be 3 months. You don't create that same kind of family mm-hmm. environment that the 9 months of Band of Brothers created, and the boot camp was part of that. So I certainly haven't, and I would doubt that there's any or many examples of things quite like Band of Brothers.
Right. And From the Earth to the Moon didn't do something like that, right?
No, that was a very different undertaking especially in terms of the cast, because the cast would come and go from episode to episode much more. Whereas in Band of Brothers, the whole cast was there on location the whole time. And it was all about those same guys the whole time. Whereas in From the Earth to Moon, you're rotating different astronauts from episode right. to episode. So the process of shooting it and the method by which the actors worked on it is really the key ingredient right. to that.
Wow. And do you know who made the decision that during Band of Brothers that they would do it this way, that they wanted everyone there the entire time? I mean, do you think it was a conscious decision, or it was just the idea that, okay, we're dealing oh, yeah. with these guys, so let's have everyone in the background, like you said before, you know, not realizing, you know, what an amazing thing they would be able to create that, again, even 25 years later, you know, a lot of the people yeah. are still, you know, in contact. And
well, it was definitely a conscious decision. I don't remember, but I would say that it was some combination of Tom and Steven, Tony Toe and Dale Dye, who was, you know, the technical advisor who was right. there to be the kind of the boot camp instructor and the ongoing. So, you know, they had done Saving Private Ryan, right? Dale mm-hmm. worked on that with Steven and Tom, and they did a boot camp. And then, you know, but of course that was a one movie, and it made sense that all the actors would be there for the whole run of the movie. This would also have the boot camp, which I'm sure Tom and Steven and Dale all wanted to do from the beginning. But the difference would be, yeah, we keep them around for the duration. Yeah, I can't say exactly whose first idea and who decided, but it's those four people would have been the key decision makers on that, oh, I think.
Makes sense. All right, anything else you want to add about Band of Brothers?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't have anything off the top of my head.
All right, well, Eric, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. This has been really enlightening. I've learned a lot about different aspects of the making of Band of Brothers, and I really do appreciate you being willing to take the time to expand my knowledge even more of it.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for doing this, and I look forward to seeing the finished product. Please keep me posted.
I will do so. Thank you very much.